Books, for example, are an excellent container for the accumulation, quiet scrutiny, and organized analysis of information and ideas. It takes time to write a book and to read one, time to discuss its contents and to make judgments about their merit, including the form of their presentation. A book is an attempt to make thought permanent and to contribute to the great conversation conducted by authors of the past. Therefore, civilized people everywhere consider the burning of a book a vile form of anti-intellectualism. But the telegraph demands that we burn its contents. The value of telegraphy is undermined by applying the tests of permanence, continuity, or coherence. The telegraph is suited only to the flashing of messages, each to be quickly replaced by a more up-to-date message. Facts push other facts into and then out of consciousness at speeds that neither permit nor require evaluation. The telegraph introduced a kind of public conversation whose form had startling characteristics. Its language was the language of headlines, sensational, fragmented, impersonal. News took the form of slogans, to be noted with excitement, to be forgotten with dispatch. Its language was also entirely discontinuous. One message had no connection to that which preceded or followed it. Each headline stood alone as its own context. The receiver of the news had to provide a meaning if he could. The sender was under no obligation to do so. And because of all this, the world as depicted by the telegraph began to appear unmanageable, even undecipherable. The line-by-line, sequential, continuous form of the printed page slowly began to lose its resonance as a metaphor of how knowledge was to be acquired and how the world was to be understood. Knowing the facts took on a new meaning, for it did not imply that one understood implications, background, or connections. Telegraphic discourse permitted no time for historical perspectives and gave no priority to the qualitative. To the telegraph, intelligence meant knowing of lots of things, not knowing about them. Thus, to the reverent question posed by Morse, "What hath God wrought?" a disturbing answer came back. A neighborhood of strangers and pointless quantity, a world of fragments and discontinuities. God, of course, had nothing to do with it. And yet, for all of the power of the telegraph, had it stood alone as a new metaphor for discourse, it is likely that print culture would have withstood its assault, would at least have held its ground. As it happened, at almost exactly the same time Morse was reconceiving the meaning of information, Louis Daguerre was reconceiving the meaning of nature, one might even say of reality itself. As Daguerre remarked in 1838 in a notice designed to attract investors, the daguerreotype is not merely an instrument which serves to draw nature, it gives her the power to reproduce herself. Of course, both the need and the power to draw nature have always implied reproducing nature, refashioning it to make it comprehensible and manageable. The earliest cave paintings were quite possibly visual projections of a hunt that had not yet taken place, wish fulfillments of an anticipated subjection of nature. Reproducing nature, in other words, is a very old idea. But Daguerre did not have this meaning of reproduce in mind. He meant to announce that the photograph would invest everyone with the power to duplicate nature as often and wherever one liked. He meant to say he had invented the world's first cloning device, that the photograph was to visual experience what the printing press was to the written word. In point of fact, the daguerreotype was not quite capable of achieving such an equation. It was not until William Henry Fox Talbot, an English mathematician and linguist, invented the process of preparing a negative from which any number of positives could be made that the mass printing and publication of photographs became possible. The name photography was given to this process by the famous astronomer Sir John F. W. Herschel. It is an odd name since it literally means writing with light. Perhaps Herschel meant the name to be taken ironically, since it must have been clear from the beginning that photography and writing, in fact language in any form, do not inhabit the same universe of discourse. Nonetheless, ever since the process was named, it has been the custom to speak of photography as a language. The metaphor is risky because it tends to obscure the fundamental differences between the two modes of conversation. To begin with, photography is a language that speaks only in particularities. Its vocabulary of images is limited to concrete representation. Unlike words and sentences, the photograph does not present to us an idea or concept about the world, except as we use language itself to convert the image to idea. By itself, a photograph cannot deal with the unseen, the remote, the internal, the abstract. It does not speak of man, only of a man, not of tree, only of a tree. You cannot produce a photograph of nature any more than a photograph of the sea. You can only photograph a particular fragment of the here and now, a cliff of a certain terrain in a certain condition of light, a wave at a moment in time from a particular point of view. And just as nature and the sea cannot be photographed, such larger abstractions as truth, honor, love, falsehood cannot be talked about in the lexicon of pictures. For showing of and talking about are two very different kinds of processes. Pictures, Gabriel Salomon has written, need to be recognized. Words need to be understood. By this he means that the photograph presents the world as object, language the world as idea. For even the simplest act of naming a thing is an act of thinking, of comparing one thing with others, selecting certain features in common, ignoring what is different, and making an imaginary category. There is no such thing in nature as man or tree. The universe offers no such categories or simplifications, only flux and infinite variety. The photograph documents and celebrates the particularities of this infinite variety. Language makes them comprehensible. The photograph also lacks a syntax, which deprives it of a capacity to argue with the world. As an objective slice of space-time, the photograph testifies that someone was there or something happened. Its testimony is powerful, but it offers no opinions, no should-have-beens or might-have-beens. Photography is preeminently a world of fact, not of dispute about facts or of conclusions to be drawn from them. But this is not to say photography lacks an epistemological bias. As Susan Sontag has observed, a photograph implies that we know about the world if we accept it as the camera records it. But as she further observes, all understanding begins with our not accepting the world as it appears. Language, of course, is the medium we use to challenge, dispute, and cross-examine what comes into view, what is on the surface. The words true and false come from the universe of language and no other. When applied to a photograph, the question, is it true, means only, is this a reproduction of a real slice of space-time? If the answer is yes, there are no grounds for argument, for it makes no sense to disagree with an unfaked photograph. The photograph itself makes no arguable propositions, makes no extended and unambiguous commentary. It offers no assertions to refute, so it is not refutable. The way in which the photograph records experience is also different from the way of language. Language makes sense only when it is presented as a sequence of propositions. Meaning is distorted when a word or sentence is, as we say, taken out of context, when a reader or listener is deprived of what was said before and after. But there is no such thing as a photograph taken out of context, for a photograph does not require one. In fact, the point of photography is to isolate images from context so as to make them visible in a different way. In a world of photographic images, Ms. Sontag writes, all borders seem arbitrary. Anything can be separated, can be made discontinuous from anything else. All that is necessary is to frame the subject differently. She is remarking on the capacity of photographs to perform a peculiar kind of dismembering of reality, a wrenching of moments out of their contexts, and a juxtaposing of events and things that have no logical or historical connection with each other. Like telegraphy, photography recreates the world as a series of idiosyncratic events. There is no beginning, middle, or end in a world of photographs, as there is none implied by telegraphy. The world is atomized. There is only a present, and it need not be part of any story that can be told. That the image and the word have different functions, work at different levels of abstraction, and require different modes of response will not come as a new idea to anyone. Painting is at least three times as old as writing, and the place of imagery in the repertoire of communication instruments was quite well understood in the 19th century. What was new in the mid-19th century was the sudden and massive intrusion of the photograph and other iconographs into the symbolic environment. This event is what Daniel Boorstin, in his pioneering book, The Image, calls the Graphic Revolution. By this phrase, Boorstin means to call attention to the fierce assault on language made by forms of mechanically reproduced imagery that spread unchecked throughout American culture. Photographs, prints, posters, drawings, advertisements. I choose the word assault deliberately here to amplify the point implied in Boorstin's Graphic Revolution,